You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 26th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Treva B. Lindsay, author of America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice. Meanwhile, Texas is still reeling from the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School. New video appears to show parents wailing in pain, begging police to charge into the school or to let them in as the officer stood outside. The shooter apparently did all, if not most, of his killing in one classroom. False conspiracy theories about the shooter being trans are circulating in right-wing online forums because, of course, we'll be talking to Matt Binder about that a little bit, hopefully, in the fun half of the program. Not that fun, but... In Congress, meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he won't move too quickly on the universal background check bill that was passed in the House. Call me crazy, but I think waiting for outrage to die over this massacre while you're whipping votes is a bad strategy. There needs to be urgency. In other Texas news, despite Henry Cuellar's declaration of victory, no other outlet has followed suit. The margin is less than 200 votes, and there are still outstanding votes to be counted, so make sure your ballot is counted if you are a Texas 28 voter. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has endorsed the whole gamut of DSA candidates in New York State. That's 13 Democratic Socialists on the ballot, the biggest DSA slate in history in the state. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed a bill that would ban almost all abortions at fertilization with narrow exceptions for medical emergencies, which would probably mean nothing. It's now officially the strictest abortion ban in the nation. The FDA has blasted the, quote, egregiously unsanitary conditions at the Abbott baby formula plant in Michigan, the shutdown plant that led to this baby formula shortage. A cleanup effort hopefully will lead to the plant reopening in a week or two. And lastly, a new large CDC finds that one in five adults under 65 who contracted COVID will have long COVID symptoms. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is good to have you. My headphones just got unplugged, so let me fiddle around with that. We're back. It's been a difficult news week, obviously, and we've been seeing a variety of different reactions to the mass shooting in Texas. Senator Ted Cruz is one of them. He's the senator from the state where this massacre happened. Let's turn to that now. This clip is going a bit viral. I say that a lot, but this one is. Because, frankly, the rest of the world can't understand what the hell is wrong with the United States. Ted Cruz was asked by Sky News' Mark Stone, who... Sky News, is that a British publication?
Yeah, I believe Rupert Murdoch owned, or at least he wanted to.
Yeah, because I think that they also have some offices in... Australia.
Yeah.
So regardless, though, I believe this is a British reporter asking Ted Cruz about whether now is the right time to push for gun control legislation. And specifically, Cruz has asked the question, why do these types of shootings happen only this commonly in the United States as opposed to other countries? And Cruz can't answer the question and basically runs away.
There are 19 sets of parents. who are never going to get to kiss their child goodnight again.
Is this the moment to reform gun laws?
You know, it's easy to go to politics.
But it's important. It's at the heart of the issue.
I get that that's where the media likes to go.
No, it's not. It's where many of the people we've talked to here like to go.
The proposals from Democrats in the media, inevitably, when some violent psychopath murders people.
A violent psychopath who's able to get a weapon so easily. 18-year-old with two AR-15s.
If you want to stop violent crime, the proposals the Democrats have, none of them would have stopped this.
But why does this only happen in your country? I really think that's what many people around the world just, they cannot fathom. Why only in America? Why is this American exceptionalism so awful?
You know, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful.
I think this aspect of it.
You get your political agenda.
No, it's honestly.
God love you.
Senator, it's not. I just want to understand why you do not think that guns are the problem.
Why is this just an American problem?
Well, it is just an American problem, sir.
Mr. Cruz, why is America the only country that faces this kind of mass shooting?
But you can't answer that. You can't answer that, can you, sir? You can't answer that. Why is this
country? Why is it that people come from all over the world to America? Because it's the freest, most prosperous, safest country on earth.
It may be the freest. It may be the most popular.
Why are our kids dying in
He said safest there at the end with a straight face.
Yeah. Why did people come here? Because theirs is being ravaged by imperial powers, probably. Like
that we have associations with if we're not directly responsible for.
Yeah.
I don't know. There are a lot of things. People come from South America, from other countries, because the United States has, with its drug war and its interferences in toppling governments, created conditions where it's entirely unsafe for people to survive. You know, people might come from the Middle East because of very similar reasons, because American imperial power has also ravaged that part of the world. So forgive me if I'm not going to bask in American exceptionalism. Notice how he sees perceiving oneself as exceptional despite the facts on the ground, as a badge of honor, right? I have not seen American exceptionalism embraced with such sincerity, as much as Ted Cruz can muster, at least, in a long time. He ran away because he's unable to answer the question, because the facts are overwhelming. In 87, there was a British mass shooting. The country banned semi-automatic weapons, and I think there was another shooting where they banned different kinds of guns, and it has one of the lowest gun-related death rates in the world. Australia, same thing, similar thing happened in the 90s. That was when they had a gun buyback program, also a decrease in gun violence and mass shootings, a significant precipitous drop. Canada also had gun reform after shootings in the 80s and 90s. New Zealand, European... I mean, I could go down the list. And when you look at the facts, it's not a difficult question. It's not a difficult question. But it becomes really difficult for Republican politicians because, you know, Matt said this before the show, they're not even doing the mental health thing right now. All Ted Cruz is doing is going on cable and saying, well, the school should have had one door. The school should have had, you know, so one...
Retrofit every school in America to have one door.
Yeah, one point of entry.
And then a fire happens. Okay, great.
That was, I mean, like, the idea, like, great job, great idea in terms of, like, fire drills, getting kids in. As Sam was saying yesterday, why don't we just, like, get rid of all of the windows, put bars on them, and every kid and every teacher is armed with a gun and is just like waiting. Let's go. They can be prisons. They can be military barracks. You know, one or the other, though. One or the other.
A couple of things I just want to react to is just that people come over to America because it's the most free place in the world. And it's like, well, there's a certain like design that's happened that has created the situation where people leave certain countries. Like as Michael Parenti says, there's no poor countries, only exploited countries. Ask multinational corporations if they think a certain country is poor, and they'll be like, oh, no, we actually have plans to go extract their resources. Also, the easy go to politics. One thing to say to that is politics are good. Politics are necessary. The second thing is, if not politics, then we need to talk about policy. And like you said, like when they're out of power and they have actually absolutely nothing to say, they make signs to like mental health or something like that. But they have nothing to offer actually that they can't act, that it, we're too close to something being done, and we were so far from something being done, to be clear. But too close for them to even put stuff like that on the table. So that's why we get all this trash about arming the teachers and one door on the school
and
system.
And architectural design suggestions. Because it's just pathetic.
Imagine them. What would their mental health program be? Honestly, it's be funny to even imagine what a Republican mental health plan would look like.
Right. I mean, what, some like encouragement to go to
Trump University's like
private healthcare program. And if you can't afford it, then your mental health, it doesn't need tending to, basically. Here's Lindsey Graham being asked a very similar question, because look, I mean, it's not just Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz is the senator from Texas, but here's Lindsey Graham being asked here by Vice reporter Emily Landers. She asked a very similar question about why the United States is so jarringly different in the area of gun violence, and Lindsey Graham has nothing really substantive to say either.
This particular shooting, are there other things we can do? Yeah, let's see if we can.
Senator, why do you think that this country is the only country in the world that constantly has mass shootings like this and elementary school shootings?
Yeah, well, we've had, one's too many. I don't have the answers to all these. I don't know why anybody would shoot their grandmother in their face, in her face, get in a car and go to a school and kill a bunch of kids. I don't know. That is beyond my ability to understand.
You don't know why, but we do know how they might be able to do that, and it's with a firearm that can kill massive amounts of people in a small amount of time.
What can I do as a lawmaker? Put cops so that when you try to go in school, shoot kids, you get shot. That seems to be one thing we can do. How do you keep guns out of
the school? It didn't work. At that school, that gunman had body armor on. How was a law enforcement official,
nobody,
if you put more in schools, able to confront that? I mean, the game has changed,
no,
Senator.
Apparently, he walked in the school without anybody stopping him. How did
That's
he
false.
So, we're at a point where there's a bunch of different lies that the police department has said. The body armor thing seems to be unconfirmed. Like, he was wearing some sort of thing that may have looked like body armor.
This clip was, I think, probably like around 18 to 24 hours old. So, what he's saying here is false.
It's unclear. Like, the police department is saying that the school resource officer engaged.
Yeah.
They keep saying
engaged.
That's the other thing that we should talk about is the just lies of police departments across this country, but especially even in this case where they're saying, they contained the shooter. You contained him in a school, in a classroom.
In one classroom where he was killing all of his murder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, that's not, that, I don't know what the word contained means, but maybe we need to send cops back to, read some dictionaries or some shit.
School. Where was the law enforcement officer to protect entry to the school? So these are the questions I'd like to ask.
Do you think we have too many guns in this country?
I think we have plenty of laws on the books about owning guns. We have red flag laws throughout the nation. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But here's what I said to the Democrat colleagues. If you think we have too many guns, let's debate, Beto O'Rourke. He had a lot to say today. He wanted to confiscate, AR-15s, have the government buy them back. I own one. Bring it up. Let's vote.
Senator.
Let's vote. Yeah. He's not going to vote for anything substantive. The reality is that at the very, very least, we need background checks, and we need to re-implement the assault weapons ban. It expired in 2004 after 10 years, and it has coincided, not coincidentally, with an increase precipitously every year in these mass shootings. 2018 to 2019 increase, 2019 to 2020 increase, 2020 to 2021 increase. And it's just going to continue to do so. The Newton, Connecticut kids at Sandy Hook, they're going into high school this year. The ones that survived. And we've done nothing since then. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Dr. Treva Lindsay. We are back, and we are joined now by Dr. Treva B. Lindsay, author of America, Goddamn Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice. Treva, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Lots of distressing and terrible news, but you know, we spent the first part of the program and a lot of this week talking about the massacre in Texas. But frankly, you know, there's assaults on people's rights and their lives and their well-being that they're about to ramp up in the form of abortion bans. In Oklahoma, they just passed the most strict abortion ban in the country, and more states are going to follow suit. So, you know, your book deals with many different facets of violence towards Black women in the United States, but specifically related to abortion. How did you react to the pending Roe v. Wade reversal as an expert in Black feminism?
Sure. I think this moment is this feeling of compounding crises. And I'm thinking a lot about a term I use in the book called unlivable living. And it feels like this moment is just propelling us further and further into this state of unlivable living. And so one of those contexts, of course, for me is reproductive justice, is reproductive autonomy. And if we're thinking about Black women and Black people with gestational capacity in particular, there's a long history of forced pregnancies and forced births. In fact, the reproductive labor of Black women and girls, if we're looking at the history of slavery in the United States and in the Americas more broadly, is intimately tied to the shoring up of the state and the building of wealth for the nation. So when I saw that line about increasing the domestic supply of infants that came from one of our justices, it was hard not to connect that to this long and inglorious and extractive and exploitative history. And that is a form of violence, to think about forced pregnancies, to a forced birth, particularly considering the high levels of maternal morbidity across racial and ethnic groups, but specifically for Black women and girls that we see, that what we're talking about here could never be a pro-life position. It is decidedly anti the lives of women, anti the lives of birthing people, anti the lives of families who are struggling to make it. When we're looking at the conditions under which people are bringing children into this world, and we can look to massacres and think about that in the context of reproductive justice as well. What kind of world are we having for our children? Ones where baby formula is not available, ones where we're forcing people to carry children to term, fetuses to term to become children, and demanding that people work and work and work and not have anywhere for them to live, not have any food to eat. These are all connected, and these are all forms of state-sanctioned violence.
100%. And I mean, we've tried to emphasize on this show how an assault on Roe and an assault on abortion rights is an assault particularly on poorer women and on non-white women, because they're all linked together, as you say. I mean, this your book's intersectional, and we try to be that way on the show as well in terms of our analysis. Just the concept of, like, this implicit societal belief that there's an ownership over Black females' bodies, and that's inherent to everything when we're debating abortion that, you know, sometimes I feel that gets swept under the rug in terms of just all of the ways that, that class, race, women's health intersects.
Absolutely. And we have to look at that. And history tells us to look at that. That when we think about reproductive justice, there's a reason that we see so many Black women and girls who've been invested in this struggle and knew even when Roe was codified that that still wouldn't be enough to protect the reproductive autonomy of marginalized communities, and that we were always warring against the potential of what we're about to see. And so we don't need to look to Handmaid's Tale to see this history. This is a history. This is a very real history that we're now living out. And as you mentioned, there's ostensibly going to be a disparate impact on marginalized communities, on poor women, on disabled communities, on Black communities by this. Because what we do know so often is that people who have resources are still able to access things. And are still able to find ways to access those, whether they be safe or legal. And that resource gap is so important in this context. Once we're talking about a nation that is wedded to forced birthing and forced pregnancy and forced parenting as a result. And those conditions distinctly impact those who are poor, those who are of color, those who do not have access to those resources. And that is so incredibly concerning and violent and harmful.
Yes. Well, it's violent, right? And
yes.
Those societal structures are naturalized. Spoken about with reverence, and yet they are instruments of violence. And what I loved about your book is how, really, you know, in so many ways, Black women and girls have been on the front lines of intersecting forms of violence for decades. And your book explores almost all angles possible in the United States, sexual violence, racist violence coming together, but also violence that is based on the structure of what capitalism in the United States and the way that we've decided to have this like anemic social or lack of social safety net, et cetera. Can you talk about all those things coming together and how much of a task that was for you to put that all together in your book?
Well, so often when we do these analyses of particular crises, we tend to kind of home in on one issue. This is racism. This is sexism. This is patriarchy. This is homophobia. And what I wanted to do is say, hey, look, we've had tools for a long time in Black feminist studies and critical race feminist studies, anti-racist feminist studies that really tell us that you can't look at a problem from just one angle. You need to see how different oppressive systems are coalescing and working with one another to create conditions of unlivable living. And so it was important for me to see how anti-Blackness, how misogyny, and more specifically, misogynoirs, coined by Moya Bailey, which is the kind of racist misogyny that Black women, girls, and women-identified people often endure, compound and create this kind of interdependent super force in our lives, which leads to houselessness, which leads to food insecurity and food deserts, which leads to a lack of access to clean water, which leads to these egregious maternal morbidity rates that also help us to understand that these are entwined with the desire for a repeated and growing and expanding working and poor class of people that bolster the wealth of others while we support corporate welfare and gut social welfare and social safety nets that capture the most vulnerable among us. And far too often, the most vulnerable among us are familiar parties. They are Black women and girls. They are undocumented people. They are disabled people. They are queer and trans people across various racial and ethnic groups. And so we have to be attentive to the multiplicity and the multitude of forces that are working in our lives and working to create conditions of exploitation and marginalization.
So let's turn to kind of working backwards in terms of your chapter structure. But since we're talking about social safety nets and poverty, Can you explore a little bit your book, the part where you talk about unlivable living, the deadly consequences of poverty, and how that particularly affects Black women? What did you find in your research there, and how does that connect to where we're at in 2022?
Yes. I was shocked to know some of the numbers around populations being unhoused, evicted, the millions of us who were food insecure prior to COVID. We know now that those numbers are even greater across the nation, that you saw such a disproportionate number of Black women being represented in all the categories you don't want to be represented in, right? More likely to live in neighborhoods that have higher incidences of violence, more likely to suffer consequences related to giving birth in both the immediate aftermath and up to a year after giving birth, most likely to be evicted, most likely to experience sexual and domestic violence or some form of police violence, most likely to be suspended or disciplined in the context of schooling. So I was just like, oh my goodness, there's no space where we see Black women overperforming outside of the context of these bound systems of oppression. And so unlivable living for me was this way of saying, and somehow Black women keep moving and prospering and getting degrees and creating families, creating communities, being organizers and activists and being dynamic in spite of these multiple warring systems that are impacting their lives. And so it was really important for me to think about not just those spectacular moments and heartbreaking, gut-wrenching moments like we saw in Buffalo just several days ago, or in Uvalde, but also thinking about the day-to-day wearing down of people and what predisposes so many of us to premature death.
What did you, you wrote this book, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, or at least you were finishing it up during that time period. In terms of like the concept, Black women, Black people in general were disproportionately represented in the essential worker category of people that were so essential that we decided to send them back to work in a pandemic and risk their health in order to uphold to make life comfortable for wealthier people, basically. How did that work into your thesis and your work, particularly in some of the areas about healthcare and poverty?
Yes, it impacted it a lot. I think this book would be very different had COVID not happened in the way that it did. And the first thing I wrote during our first kind of lockdown, and I hate saying lockdown because I don't think we ever fully really locked down, but in that first big wave back in March and April, the first piece that I wrote was Black women will be disparately impacted by COVID. It was a predictor that, contrary to the belief that this would be the great equalizer, we're all at home, we're all doing this, that this instead would be the great magnifier of so many inequities that were already working. So I knew that poor and working class workers, that Black people would be overrepresented in those categories, overrepresented in the categories of those who wouldn't be able to work from home in order to keep this machine going, to keep this semblance of normalcy amidst an unprecedented global crisis going, that we would be sacrificed. And then we found out from studies that once people knew that Black people, marginalized communities were being disparately impacted more so than white, wealthier communities, that the empathy gap started to close, that the ways that we connected and saw ourselves connected in this great equalizer were evaporating. And at the core of that is anti-Blackness, and that we were talking about, well, maybe it's because of all these comorbidities that these communities, but no one's asking, how did we wind up with these comorbidities?
Yeah.
And why aren't we naming anti-Black racism as a comorbidity alongside these other things to understand, yes, we had less access to healthcare before this happened. So of course, a crisis that we know nothing about is going to exacerbate the level at which we're experiencing the worst of this crisis.
Yeah, I'm going to blank on the statistic, but we were talking about it on the show the other day about that there was a study where they polled students who were studying to become doctors, and an overwhelming number of them thought that there was a likelihood that all of these racist tropes could be true about patients, like that Black people have thicker skin or a higher pain tolerance. Yes. I mean, these are so deeply ingrained that, yes. you know, just the flippant remark about, oh, comorbidities, that's probably a personal failing, right? You know, I mean,
yes.
And so as opposed to viewing all of these things as connected, which I love that emphasis of yours, they're siloed, and that's a way to continue to perpetuate anti-blackness because it makes the conditions of poverty a personal failing.
Right. It makes it invisible almost, yeah. right? It makes it this, as you said, individualistic. You're making these bad choices. It's your diet. It's not food deserts. It is that you are not relieving stress and doing the proper things to care or self-care for oneself when you're having to work 80 to 90 hours a week and low-wage work that barely gets you in housing in most cities across the country. And so that exacerbation that was brought on by COVID was just harrowing. But to know that the medical industrial complex, as I talk about it in the book, is built upon experimentation on Black people and specifically Black women and girls, whether we're talking about gynecology or if we're talking about just heart conditions or various conditions across this. These were plantation doctors, slavery plantation doctors are at the core of our medical history. And you can't just root that out by saying, hey, we're not racist anymore. It's built in.
Yeah.
So yes, in 2021 and 2022, you have medical students who still believe that Black people don't experience pain in the same way that other groups do. And what does that mean for us? What kinds of consequences does that have? And I believe those consequences have and have shown to be quite fatal, that those beliefs hold so strong in the ways that we care for one another, which is why I call it careless care. In the book, that's yeah. what so many vulnerable communities are experiencing.
Can you expand a little bit on that history that you referenced there about doctors, plantation doctors, their role in experimenting on Black women? I mean, a lot of people know some of this history, but I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about it.
So one of the ways I love to talk about this is when the COVID vaccine was announced, what we noticed was there were racial disparities in how people were thinking about the vaccine, the skepticism and cynicism around the vaccine. And one of the key studies that was referenced for a lot of Black skepticism and cynicism around this was the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, probably one of the most well-known horrific, heinous ethical violations in the history of modern medicine, whereby Black men who had syphilis were not treated intentionally so that doctors could observe how syphilis ran. And so there was no treatment or anything afforded. Were that the only example of medical experimentation at the expense of Black people, that would be horrific enough. But sadly, dating back from his early records and medical journals from the 18th century, we see this kind of experimentation on enslaved people. And whether that's looking at bacterial infections, early research on that, research that now we can have what we call our pap smears and vaginal examinations for various gynecological conditions were built on experimenting painfully on enslaved Black women without any form of anesthesia or painkiller that would be contemporaneous. Or we can look at processes of forced sterilization that emerged and are part of a long history of both experimentation and violation of Black women from everywhere across the United States, from places like Mississippi, where someone like a Fannie Lou Hamer got a forced hysterectomy. It was so common, it was called the Mississippi appendectomy. Or we can look even at Puerto Rico, where a third of Puerto Rican women during the mid-20th century were forcibly sterilized. And so there's this incredible history of violence through medicine that we see, and that experimentation on who's seen as disposable. And so much of my book, so much of my argument is about the politics of disposability and who we care about or who we care enough about to move. And by caring, I mean people other than Black women, because Black women and girls care about other Black women and girls. So we're not no one. So you'll never hear me saying no one cares about Black girls and women. We do. And that matters. And we are not no one. But in a larger, broader sense, anytime we see this disparate thing, I don't think we would be talking about fibroids in some distant way if 80% of people across races and ethnicities experience them. But because up to 80% of Black women and girls, Black folks with vaginas, will have fibroids at some point in their life, that's a medical crisis that yes. we've yet to really grapple with, right? And so there's a distance between not only our empathy, but structurally what that empathy, that lack of empathy then means. It is fatally consequential. It's injuriously inconsequential.
I want to return to the concept of some of those forced sterilizations, because we see that migrants were yes. facing that violence still to this day. But when you're taught, we're still on the I want to move again to incarceration and things like that. But while we're still on healthcare, can you talk a bit about the disparity in maternal mortality from white people, white women, or white people who can give birth in this country versus black yes. people? Because that is another stark example and one of the most compelling points when discussing this.
Yes. So, you know, thinking about the gentleman from Louisiana who recently said our mortality rates wouldn't be so bad if we took out African Americans, right? We wouldn't be so far off the norm, which still is untrue, that it would still be quite stark that a lot of people die giving birth in this country, far more than should, given the tremendous amount of wealth that we have in this country. But for Black women, we've seen everything from 2.5 times more likely to die as a result of childbirth, and in maternal morbidity and mortality are slightly different. One is referring to in the immediate kind of 42 days after one gives birth. The larger number is actually thinking about this in terms of a year. And once we do that, that number can increase to as high as 3 to 4 times as high when we look at that comparison. And also of note, even more so than dying during childbirth, the highest rate, the highest time for a woman to experience violence in her life is when she's pregnant, right? A Black woman is 2.5 times more likely to be killed when she's pregnant. And I frame that in the context of reproductive justice as well. What kinds of things and opportunities are we creating? And when you look at someone like a Serena Williams, who even she almost dies giving birth, who has access to resources, one of literally the most visible people on the planet, imagine what that means for poor Black women. Imagine what that means for undocumented women and people with gestational capacity who are in detention centers, who are dying to give birth, literally. And so I wanted to put that into some kind of context, because we see this across class as well. So many people thought that this is a class issue, that it's for women. It is Black women broadly that we've studied where we see these disparate outcomes around childbirth. And so we have to start naming racism, not race, racism. And we have to start naming anti-Blackness in order to fully grapple with what's happening and this incredible disparity in maternal mortality and morbidity rates.
Well, I also just think it's naive just to assign it to class, right? Because that mm-hmm. is a through line, of course. And when we're talking about women at the border, women in immigrant detention facilities where these experiments, these sick experiments are happening, that is the through line. But anti-Blackness and classism, particularly in the United States, it's inextricable.
Absolutely. And we have to be honest about that when grappling with these issues, right? I'm very, very acutely aware of how poor as category and structured within capitalism disparately impacts. My experiences in a number of these categories look very different as someone who is upper middle class Black woman than some of my sisters who are poor Black women, poor disabled Black women. Those look different. However, there is a through line. And when we look at something like maternal morbidity and maternal mortality, we can actually see that through line and have to tease out what becomes salient in our analysis. And what needs to become salient is the ways that anti-Blackness is continuously operating.
Absolutely. Let's turn to the criminal, as you put it, punishment system, not justice system, and the ways that that has manifested itself as state violence against Black women. We cited some of these horrific examples about healthcare in the carceral system, but there are other parts of it that we should flesh out. So, do you mind doing that for us?
Sure. So I wanted to look at the carceral system and mass incarceration, or what we call targeted mass incarceration, because often even in social justice and racial justice circles, we almost exclusively are talking about men and boys, and more specifically cisgender men and boys. And I knew from my own experience, which this book is this blend of history and personal experience, as well as this political and cultural analysis, to say, I know Black women are disparately impacted, and not just indirectly because our loved ones are being impacted by this, but literally being locked up. And so I looked at a case like Sandra Bland and thought about her death in police custody and wondered if there were others. And sure enough, in the same month that she died in police custody, so did four other Black women. And what were the circumstances? Some of them were medical neglect. Some of them were failed mental health assessments before putting someone in there. And all of them were petty incidences of harm, right? Unpaid fines, failure to signal a lane change, petty larceny. These were not in any way capital offenses as deemed by our criminal punishment system. So I wanted to look at something like that to talk about targeted mass incarceration in one way. And then another way, looking at Black women and girls who are criminalized for surviving violence, right? And if we look at prisons, jails in the United States, so many of the Black women and girls who are in juvenile facilities or prisons and jails have a history of violence in their communities, whether that is surviving violence in domestic context, intimate partner context, communal context, but they are surviving incredible forms of violence. And so I wanted to look at girls and women who had been targeted by the criminal punishment system for surviving violence, for defending themselves, and looking at the limitations of self-defense and stand your ground as they're positioned in our legal discourse as it pertains to Black women and girls.
Well, that's not legal. That's not a law. That's just right. Fend for yourself, and we don't really want to deal with it. And of course, that's going to disproportionately affect Black women.
Right, because we already don't care about you. So what would that mean? So I had to really dig in and see how many of these cases that we talk about can we find this climate of violence that surrounds what happens when this person then encounters the criminal punishment system. So even before that, what are our encounters with policing looking like? What does that look like in our schools? You know, in the aftermath of a shooting, right, there's so many calls for more policing in schools. Well, those of us who grew up with policing in our schools, who were targeted by police in our schools, might have a different relationship to that call to action than other folks do who are worried newly about their experiences of safety in school, whereas Black girls very rarely are safe in schools as they stand from people we don't necessarily identify as threats. But I think it's important to think about the criminal punishment system as a broad apparatus, not just policing and jails and prisons and detention centers, but all of the ideas about Black women, the ways we pathologize Black communities, the ways that we understand who is criminal and who is not. All of those things play into what shapes the criminal punishment system and who experiences it as a punishment system and who experiences it as a justice system. And somewhere in between, those who experience it simply as a legal system, which is still predicated upon anti-Blackness and capitalism and sexism and patriarchy and transphobia and all of these other systems of oppression.
What's your take on... this is more, you know, back in connecting this to the news a little bit. Biden's State of the Union, the part that made my blood boil was when he said, fund the police, and screamed it a bunch of times, and he got a standing ovation for it. And he felt that he needed to do it because there's this notion that's completely disconnected from any facts on the ground that the defund the police is really going to hurt Democrats in purple districts as Pelosi and Clyburn go to campaign for an anti-choice pro-gun Democrat in Texas. But it's just he felt that he needed to say that, right? But what do you make of that calculus by the Democratic president? Is it just indicative of how ingrained this is, or is it more than that?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? I think it is an ingraining. I think a lot of us are invested in a criminalizing imagination that we don't understand a world in which policing isn't intimately interwoven into every institution and system. But I'm also seeing familiar historical ground here, that once again, as we see violence and harm kind of raise up in numbers, right? They're intensifying in our communities. Objectively speaking, they're intensifying. Still nowhere near the highest rates of these things, but certainly intensifying. And I understand people's concerns. Once again, Democrats are trying to prove we're tough on crime. Well, we know where that led us before. We all have had this conversation that mass incarceration might have been wrong. It impacted Black communities in these ways. And yet we're heading down the same path again with some of the same players. Biden was absolutely present and a formidable architect of the crime bill that set up our kind of current iteration of policing and the criminal punishment system. And so we're heading there again. And that funding the police, that recurring mantra that you're hearing from so many Democrats, we need to invest more, we need to do more, with no sense of what does that even look like. We have no receipts to prove that this works. And yet we do have receipts that when we see better wages, when we see housing, when we see food security, when we see our schools funded, when we see families supported instead of ripped apart by the state, that we have better outcomes all around in terms of how harm is happening. It's deciding for many that catching, that using a failed political calculus will somehow yield a different result.
Right. I mean, I'm all of these concepts that you discuss, they're so obvious to me, but, you know, that's because I'm on the left and we do this show every day. But, you know, some people have a hard time making the connection. One of the examples I think of is how environmental racism is mocked by the right. And I do think some people are having a hard time connecting with it. Do you mind fleshing out that concept a little bit? Because communities of color, Black women too, are going to bear the brunt of climate change and other areas outside the United States, particularly in the global South. That's another form of racism as well. I know this isn't really a focus of yours here, but I'm wondering if I could call on your expertise.
Absolutely. So, you know, again, climate change is a racial justice issue as well at the global level. And so we can think about this in terms of deforestation, if we're thinking about the global South and the impact that that has and the communities it directly impacts that we're thinking about, or we can look at Flint. I do talk about Flint here. This is a case of both environmental and structural racism colluding in a way that you see, I mean, just communities decimated by the lack of clean water and decisions that how we treat our water, how we engage water, the fact that people are trying to commodify and say there's no legal right to water, a thing we need to survive, that is deeply connected to this. Instead, we want to invest in pipelines. We want to invest in energy sources that we know create the context where generation after generation will be more and more on the brink of collapse and being extinct. And I think we're setting ourselves up for an extinction level event. But of course, because this causes droughts, this causes food shortages, this causes unsustainable living practices across the world that, again, poor people are going to be disparately impacted by. Right. And so I think we have to be clear that the pending and existing climate crises that we're facing are being the brunt of that right now is already being borne by communities of color throughout the global South and in the United States, and poor people in these communities who are fighting and warring to say, we have to do something now propelling us. But we experience factories in our communities. We experience pipelines through our communities that are building and spilling into ours, in our water sources, in our underground sources for energy. These are disparately impacting us. And so environmental racism for me is that connection between the structural result of a politics of disposability. These communities are disposable so that my life can be more comfortable in the following ways. And I don't have to think about that because I'm not experiencing it in the ways that they are, right? So even if a natural disaster like a hurricane, which at this point is a social and natural disaster that's happening, I'll be able to rebuild. I have insurance. I can just move. I can do these things. But you're not thinking about those communities that were just displaced and decimated by this new wave of increasingly intense weather incidents and disaster incidents.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to touch on the part of your book towards the end where it's more personal and you talk about the weight of, you know, all of these structures of violence. They have their own weight, but also the social hatred and consequences from those structures that you had to personally experience. Why did you feel it was important to include your own experience at the end, and how was that writing about that for you?
Yes, very tough to write about my own experiences, but in the intro, I said these stakes are personal. They are communal, but this is an intimate book in many ways, that as a Black woman, I've experienced a number of these forms of violence. I have friends, family, loved ones who've experienced these forms of violence. And I wanted to make sense of that. And I wanted to use my tools as a historian, as someone who's consistently engaged in these conversations about why violence is happening, why harm is happening, and where does the hope reside with regards to how we move forward in this. And so the personal for me allowed me to do this thing I call in the book called witnessing. So witnessing is we observe, we engage, we talk about this. The witnessing is like, I sit with this. This is consequential for me. This is consequential for people I love. I'm not writing about Black women. I'm writing from among us. And I think that helped for the book to resonate in a different way with people, that there's something at stake. And here's all the history, here are all these data points. We can mine through all of that, but come in for a second and sit with the intimate details of what it means to not be believed when you've been sexually violated. Sitting as I think about having three friends who were killed by their partners before I even turned 35 years old. What does it mean to actually sit with those kinds of harms in a way that the person who's kind of curating this story for you is bringing you in, inviting you in to sit with it alongside her.
Yeah, I think it really put a button on, or was just like a great way to wrap things up. And while this will be my last question for you, while we are kind of looking at the book more from a 30,000 foot view, the title of the book is a callback to this Nina Simone song. And I didn't realize that she had written this in the wake of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, among other incidents. So I guess, why was the titling important to you in a way to call back to that horrific mm-hmm. moment in history? And I mean, there's a poeticism to it as well, because it underlies a lot of what you write about.
Yes. So Nina is a guide for me as a post for me. And I thought about the fact that that was her first kind of protest song that she ever recorded. And it was inspired by the kind of onslaught of anti-Black violence that was happening and these incidences that were happening, but in particular, the 16th Street Baptist Church. But so often we remember those who were killed as the four little girls. We don't name them. So we're not saying Addie, Carol, Denise, and Cynthia and saying her name. And so it reminded me in that 2015 report by Andrea Ritchie and Kimberly Crenshaw, the Say Her Name report, which is documenting police violence against Black women and girls, that's insistence that we name it. And not just because it's important to say the names, but I wanted to have life-affirming details so that it's not just the spectacular moment of violence and erasure that we come to understand who they were. I wanted you to know that they were brownies and loved singing and were good at math and would go door to door and sell products in Black and white neighborhoods in the 1960s in Alabama. I wanted readers to connect that intimacy to build. And I think with Simone choosing such a horrific incident, it was a reminder for me of what Say Her Name in fact means, that it's asking us to do a deeper kind of excavation under what are the circumstances under which, the conditions under which Black women and girls are living and being killed and being injured and being assaulted. And so the song was a perfect encapsulation of that and a nod to someone which just had seen so much, who had engaged so much, that she had to put this into a 3.5 minute tune to say, Mississippi goddamn. And in this to say, America, we're still here. We're still doing these things. We're still terrorizing vulnerable communities.
Yeah, I mean, she's pretty cool. So yes. I appreciated that title for sure. Dr. Treva B. Lindsay, author of America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice. Treva, can't thank you enough for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Really love the conversation.
Same here. Of course. All right, folks, with that, we are going to head into the fun half where we will have fun, I promise. We won't just talk about the shooting. We will talk about other things. But Matt Binder has been tracking some of these conspiracy theories about who the shooter is on the right. So I want to pick his brain about that.
We're going to do some calls for censorship.
Yes.
Candace Owens should lose her Twitter account. I'm sorry.
Wait, so what happened with her?
She was she tweeted out that apparently the shooter was in photos like cross-dressing or something like that.
That was her? Did she start this whole thing or is she taking it from...
She was, you know, imbibing it and propagating
it. Naturally,
she's
derivative. Yeah.
And I mean, she's... And then she's like, actually, that wasn't what I was... And she's just a liar. And
yeah.
Twitter should be able to ban a person like that without people acting like it's Daniel Ellsberg getting suppressed with the Pentagon Papers.
Yes. So with that said, though, Matt, what did you talk about on Left Reckoning? How was the show last night?
Yeah, we had a conversation with Matt Huber, who has a book, Climate Change as Class War, which I think does a lot of... good reframing of the issue in a way that has been, I think, a little bit diluted by, let's say, NGO activism and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we need to get a little bit more serious about, you know, talking about how much less you're flying or something like that is nice. But as Matt Huber points out, like, who's profiting off that privilege of you flying? It's private capitalists in their industry. And we need to be seizing all of these industries that are massive polluters and, we can't just depend on people's like guilt to cause consumer behavior to change in a way that does anything. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Griscom and I also talked about how Elon Musk apparently offered a horse in exchange for a hand job. I don't know if you heard this story.
What?
Yeah.
Was that the thing on the plane or is that a separate thing? Like, that he offered a horse? Yeah. I thought people were just joking based on the dollar figure that was offered that you could buy like a horse with it, but that's actually what happened.
My understanding was that he's like, I'll give you a horse, and but the important thing we talked about actually was he put out the call for a team of lawyers to sue people for a free speech. I don't know, you could just call up Peter Thiel. I think they probably have each other's phone numbers. He's probably got some advice on that stuff. But the free speech warriors become the suing people because of speech warriors. It's going to happen with Elon. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that post game.
Okay. Awesome. That sounds good. We're going to bring in Binder and Brandon now. There. Whoa. Seamless, Bradley. Very, very nice. What's up, guys? Brandon, you're muted, though.
I am muted. Sorry.
No longer.
You're also coming out of my TV for some reason. So it's like, you know, I'm really talking to my screen now.
Oh, wow. That's high tech.
Yeah. Did you guys miss me?
Yes.
You say yes, even if you didn't.
We did. You were missed. And you didn't even get to, like, bask in Binder's Tim Pool debate. We broke that down for like an hour on the show last week.
You don't bask in a pool, you soak, or I guess swim.
I don't know if you want to soak
or sink.
In that one.
Yeah. That would be the kind of pool that like has way too much dirt on the bottom and you just say, I'm gonna sit outside and maybe I'll dip my toes in, but that's about it. Anyway, what's up guys? Hope you had a good vacation. Brandon, Binder, what's happening on Scam Economy and Doomed? And
Binder is frozen.
All right. Brandon, what's happening on... he had to drop out. All right. Yeah. What's happening on the discourse, Brandon?
Well, I was on vacation.
Presentations, things like that. Oh, should be a good time. So if
Binder,
you're in Brooklyn,
sorry,
at that
Binder,
little
Matt,
Binder, you cut out.
You were gone that basically entire time until just now.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yes.
What's going on? Why is that the case? That's so weird
you're
how that
happens.
A little
bit choppy now, but we're going to let Brandon go, see if you can stick on through that, and then we'll maybe...
Yeah, then you can plug.
Because it looked like you might have froze up again.
All right, Brandon, plug the discourse, and then we'll figure this out.
I feel bad now. I was on vacation, so I don't think that there was any recording in my absence, but we will have an episode up later this week. I'm on my post-vacation high. I have not been brought down by, you know, the weight of my personal life yet. So I'm raring to go. I'm ready to, you know, use that excitement to deliver better quality content to all of my fans and haters alike.
Where'd you go? Can you say?
Away.
There you go.
Okay. Good.
Oh, I think Matt's back.
Matt's back.
Hey, Bender.
Hey, how does this work? It sound good? Am I coming through?
Let's give it a shot. Yeah.
What's happening on the discourse? On Scam Economy and Doomed. Oh my God.
Oh man.
All right. Let's.
Yeah.
Let's go into the fun half. We'll be
This is the crypto people taking Matt down. Finally, he was about to blow up all of their malfeasance on Scam Economy. I can only assume that that's what this week's episode is about. Tether and blowing up, you know, the entirety of their scam. Oh, he's back again. I won't speak for him. Oh,
he's
wait,
froze
no.
again. This
he's
is
frozen.
Gonna
continue to speak for him then.
This is gonna be interesting. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start
life. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.